Welcome to this seminar this evening. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm director of the Hellenic Observatory here at the OSC. And tonight is the first of our events program for the academic year. And you'll be able to find all information about our upcoming Hellenic Observatory events online. Simply Google and you can find them. Before I begin tonight, let me just highlight two events which are coming up very soon. Our next event after tonight is this coming Monday. And the discussion from our panel on Monday will be Where Best for the Parthenon Marbles? Identity and the Cultural Repatriation of National Treasures. And that's Monday, 6:30. And we're delighted that we have Professor Paul Cartledge of University of Oxford, University of Cambridge, Lord Ed Vasey, and from the LSE, Titania Vlessas, from the Law Department. And then soon afterwards, the following week, on Tuesday, the 25th of October, we have an economics seminar, Yanis Kaplanis, talking about entrepreneurship and firm resilience in times of crisis, evidence from Greece. So do please look at our events program, and I'm sure you'll find something of interest there. Let me also say that soon we will be making a public announcement about the Greek Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, coming to the LSE on Monday the 28th of November at 7 p.m. So do please look at our websites. Tonight, we're starting with a book launch for the book Crisis, Reform and the Way Forward in Greece, edited by Professor Calliope Spanou. And we are delighted to welcome Calliope, of whom I'll say more in a moment, but also delighted to welcome Jens Bastian, one of the contributors to the same volume. Of course, the Greek crisis was in the international headlines around the world after 2009 for so long, and international news coverage followed its twists and turns. The three bailouts, the associated austerity measures, etc. Economists have looked at the bailouts and debated the policy content, whether it's the right design, whether the austerity was too draconian, etc. International institutions have looked at the role of the IMF, of the EU, the Troika, the task force, in terms of their intervention engagements with Greece, and done their own evaluations of that engagement. But tonight we're focusing on a more political science perspective, questions about the capacity of the Greek system to reform capacity, the effectiveness of external intervention, and the scope for the empowerment or otherwise of domestic actors, the impact of agency and of structure in bringing about change and reform. Big political science questions about reform within the system. And we're going to be looking at those in the discussion this evening. So let me introduce our two speakers. Calliope Spanou is Professor of Administrative Science and Public Administration at the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens. From 2011 to 2015, she was the Greek Ombudsman, and previously she'd served as the Deputy Ombudsman for Greece. She has extensive experience in administrative reform in Greece, as well as in other countries. Par excellence, she is the expert on public institutions and administration in Greece, the go-to person for expertise on this matter. She has a PhD from the University of Picardy in France. She's held various posts in different institutions in Paris, in Florence, and elsewhere. And she has a very extensive list of publications, groundbreaking publications. Jens Bastian is currently fellow at the Center for Applied Turkey Studies of the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, SWP, in Berlin, in Germany. From September 2011 to September 2013, Jens was appointed by the European Commission as a member of the Task Force for Greece in Athens. His previous professional experience has included working as a lead economist for the European Agency for Reconstruction. And similarly, he's also held various academic positions at St. Anthony's College in Oxford, at Nuffield College in Oxford, and most importantly, at the London School of Economics. He has been a senior policy advisor at ELIMET in Athens and holds a PhD from Florence, the European University Institute in Florence. Let me say that after this evening's seminar, we will have a reception on the ground floor of this building, and I believe you will be able to buy copies of the book. In any event, you can go online to the Hellenic Observatory website and you will be able to purchase the book through the website at a significant discount, a 30% discount. So we're going to begin with, I think, Kalliopi speaking first and then Jens. I will then respond with some questions for both of them. And we very much look forward to your contributions and your questions for the discussion after. So let me pass and say a warm welcome to both of our speakers, but Kalliopi to begin.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you for this invitation, or the staff of the Hellenic Observatory for this opportunity. The starting point of this seminar is a book, an edited book, and in that sense I represent a common effort, and I need to refer to all my co-authors without whom this would not have been accomplished. Now, the idea of the book emerged in mid-2018 when Greece was exiting the third adjustment program, and it was to take stock of what led to the economic crisis, the changes that took place in various policy areas, and try and look ahead and beyond. Last August, as you know, Greece exited the post-program enhanced surveillance, but this took place in a quite different world, with new pressing challenges to be addressed. So while finalizing the book in 2021, reflecting on the introduction, I had realized that for more than a decade, Greece was confronted with multiple crises: economic, political, migration, security, global health crisis. And at this very moment, we are in the middle of an energy crisis as a side effect of the unthinkable, the war on the European continent. So, increased volatility in the environment is the new normal, and there is hardly any time to take a breath and think ahead. So in such a testing context, problems may change, but what matters most is how they're approached. In other words, government matters. And in this respect, understanding a crisis as deep and long as the Greek debt crisis may provide some hint for the future. Tonight, I have the chance to share with you some thoughts and indeed to reflect on the book, its contribution, its deeper messages, as well as to try and see beyond it. So, coming to the structure of the book, just a few words, it's divided in two parts. The first part, looking back, Shepherd, Serpents and Resilience. The chapters look at the developments leading up to the crisis and the test this represented for the political and institutional system in Greece. The various authors highlight their field of expertise, the background of the developments from the previous decade. Questions raised are how much Greece managed to adjust to a changing international environment up until the crisis. How did its political and institutional system deal with and responded, dealt with, and responded to the crisis? And how did society react to the light expectations from EU membership and for prosperity? The second part, looking ahead, opportunities and challenges. It comprises analysis and assessments of the developments that occurred in selected policy areas during the economic adjustment period. The authors look primarily into areas which were directly linked to the diagnostics of the sovereign debt crisis. High debt, deficits, low competitiveness, and public sector inefficiencies. In this part, the underlying question is the reform capacity of the Greek state, a subject on which Professor Featherstone has extensively worked. To what extent did this turbulent decade reveal resilience or provided a window of opportunity for deeper change in Greece? Addressed are questions such as how the state tried to reform itself, what kind of policy responses it provided to critical economic challenges, as for instance encouraging and attracting investments, improving the business environment, and correcting labor market distortions. The consensus was that a new growth model centered on investments and exports rather than consumption was necessary. This implied structural reforms to address the underlying economic low economic competitiveness and state inefficiencies. A deeper issue is how reforms were conceived in or out of the box, and how they were received by their recipients. All these inquiries closely linked to deeper governance issues that came to light and need to be addressed. That was equally a quest for regaining credibility, both vis-à-vis the EU and domestic society. I believe that all contributions provide a basis to reflect on the past, but also on the dilemmas of a future fraught with unpredictability, as the new challenges are showing. Now, allow me to highlight two different but interrelated issues. First, how the political system and society interaction perceived the crisis and, through that, the role of the EU. This describes the context of the reform effort undertaken. Now, the way the EU managed the financial refugee crisis, but basically the financial crisis, and particularly its presence in the Troika, deeply affected its perception within Greek society. It contributed to a broad Euroscepticism. It is interesting to know that in 2009, Greek public opinion considered the EU as best able among global actors, such as the US, the IMF, G20, etc., to take collective action against the effects of the financial crisis. That was a 38%, by far the highest among the EU27. These are a Euromonitor data. But the debt crisis was a game changer. On the other side, equally important is the way Greek political leaders, and more specifically the three elected prime ministers, approached the crisis and the rhetoric they developed around the role of the EU in handling it. Official discourse and public opinion were a dynamic interaction following the escalation of the crisis and the ensuing domestic political polarization. The respective rhetoric of the three prime ministers built upon and against each other. A mainstream rhetoric defended the EU, the euro, and Greek membership, but it took different twists depending on the prime minister in question. ministers, Papandreou and Samaras, defended the EU and Greek membership, not in the least discussing the idea of Brexit. While they saw the EU as safe haven, solidarity as an agent for modernization and rationalization, they differed in the way they saw external actors and their reform requirements. Papandreou did not accept the conspiracy theories that the Commission or the IMF wanted to harm Greece, even though he disagreed with their way of dealing with the problem, which he partly attributed to speculators. He also considered reform as a credibility test for Greece. Samaras blamed the first memorandum and played the national dignity card vis-a-vis foreigners who dictate conditions. More Europe is for both a solution to the economic crisis and later to the refugee crisis. But Papandreou also talks about a different EU. The contending rhetoric now, developed by Prime Minister Tsipras, built selectively on both these discourses, radicalizing them. He put the blame on a bad EU, which describes economic orthodoxy, fiscal discipline, and unaccountable technocracy, the lack of respect of the popular will as expressed by its government, and national dignity. This bad EU is also a Europe fortress, blocking the road to refugees running away from war. However, he talked about a different, a good EU, which respects its founding principles, popular sovereignty, the values of solidarity and humanitarianism. And he claimed a leading role in fighting for this good EU. It is in this rhetorical context that required reforms had to be undertaken, and even more, to convince a society under enormous pressure that while unpopular, they were necessary. Disillusionment with the EU and the growing Euroscepticism accompanied the collapse of trust in the EU. In the May 2016 Eurobarometer, trust in the EU was lower than in the UK ahead of the Brexit referendum. Since then, there is a very slow recovery of the image of the EU in public opinion. While EU and Euro membership, as well as the need for further integration, were confirmed at a political level, the nuance of the political rhetoric do not seem to reach fast enough society. The effect of the negative official discourse on public opinion seems stronger than any positive message it could convey, such as the humanitarian and democratic European values, a safe haven, or the clear pro-EU stance of the prime ministers. Now, with the new challenges ahead, developments are, in this respect, still open-ended. The second point I would like to focus on has to do with the issue of reform capacity, which is generally considered as low in Greece. What have been the reform achievements during these times? How much has changed? And what were the dynamics of external pressure and domestic agents? Crisis is supposed to be a window of opportunity to tackle all problems in new ways, to overcome the so-called past dependencies and undertake deep reforms. Most of the time, such conditions imply a domestic reconsideration of past choices. Indeed, the crisis opportunity mandate played strongly during the early years of the crisis. However, it is hard to predict what may come out of the crisis. The way involved actors use the opportunities cannot be predetermined. This is where this discussion meets the idea of reform capacity. Greece, as we know, appears as a reluctant reform or as a low reform capacity country. And the heavy presence of external actors, so-called troika institutions, as they were named later, complicated things. Gradually, the reform agenda almost changed hands and was shaped by external pressure due to the economic adjustment programs and their strict conditionality. Under the extreme pressure on society and the political system, the crisis as opportunity idea did not manage to survive. It lost credibility and steam. It is a general assessment of the authors of the book that What was presented as a remedy, that is the long list of structural reforms, was not necessarily or always what was really needed. This poses a further question, that is the one of appropriateness of the reform agenda. The reform requirements and the involvement of external actors were not necessarily translated into policy priorities that were critical for the future of Greece. They often focused on short-term fiscal results and a mechanistic box-ticking. And there was no evaluation of the concrete policies implemented and the goals achieved. There are multiple examples. The area of administrative reform, for example, despite the extent and ambition of the Big Bang approach, the reform did not always touch on critical priorities. Public sector restructuring did not really focus on stimulating competition. And while the asymmetrical growth between the non-tradable and tradable sector was at the heart of the crisis, the shift towards an export-led economy was insufficiently prioritized. In some, reforms were hastily designed and implemented, short-term and fiscally oriented, and often with unclear priorities and long-term goals. This seems to have been indirectly acknowledged by the shift to qualitative reforms and a larger room for domestic design under a third adjustment program. A valuable effect was, however, the building of tools in various policy areas that could contribute to better policy making in the future. Reforms need agency, and this leads to the issue of domestic versus external actors. Quite frequently, the role of domestic actors is considered as one of permanent resistance to change, insufficient or superficial implementation. Achievements are credited to the external actors and the pressure they apply. Such a description is at least unfair. Governments had a critical role in promoting change, even uneven, depending on the policy sector and specific period of time. Reform fatigue was acknowledged already in 2014 as a result of drastic fiscal consolidation alongside successive waves of legislative changes in a short amount of time. However, changes took place in this difficult condition, and it is important to keep in sight that domestic agency has a large part in it. I think that a balanced assessment of the political economy of reform in Greece is yet to come. And this leads to my last point, the depth of reform. Reform can be understood in many ways, smaller or deeper changes, incremental or drastic ones, etc. We chose a book to conceptualize reform as a significant departure from the status quo, that is, reforms that challenge policy legacies and corresponding implicit arrangements in a substantial way. What often is missed is the time dimension of changes. Without entering the theoretical discussion, it helps reminding that an appropriate time span to assess policy change is considered to be a 10-year period. This in order to allow time for implementation and production results. Seen under this slide, certain early assessments that reforms did not advance or that there was no change were by definition hasty. It is widely acknowledged that when structural reforms are undertaken parallel with drastic fiscal consolidation, difficulties increase, and that needs to be taken into account. And the legitimacy of external constraint is also debatable. What might be more interesting, and this is where the book tries to make a contribution, is the pattern of reforms during these difficult economic adjustment years. And this pattern refers to domestic as well as to external agents. It involves the way the reform agenda was set, the reform priorities, strategies, the continuity and consistency of effort, which may be seen as an expression of consensus of the need to promote reforms. Now, despite the variety of situations, changes have occurred, sometimes too many, too frequently, or too fast. insufficiently targeted or prioritized, and the assessment is mixed. In certain sectors, there is bigger change, and it may be incremental, but in a consistent way. An avalanche of so-called drastic but inconsistent or superficial changes is counterproductive. And this also happens in some areas. Now, the book attempts to take a closer look and unveil this variety to point to what was missed, underestimated, or discreetly left untouched. In a nutshell, what was at stake during these 10 years and remains important for the future was the development of the domestic capacity to set goals and to design and implement policies. But this was not the objective of the adjustment programs. This is an important lesson learned from this experience. Not only does external pressure have limits, and Professor Featherstone has also argued about it, but it is hardly ever meant to develop internal capacity for endogenous reform. This needs to be part of the domestic learning process, which seems to have started, albeit unevenly, and is at times undermined by political polarization. Ideas need to mature within society and the political system, thus preparing the future more and more unpredictable. With the new crisis adding up, it is important to follow how new challenges are met.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes.
Well, first of all, dear audience, ladies and gentlemen, thank you that you are and continue to be interested in Greece and Greek matters. That's not a given compared to 10 years ago, for example. Second issue is that I'm happy to be back at the LSE, as Kevin mentioned, to see friends and former colleagues. And let me emphasize that, because he was a dear and remains a dear colleague, but one is missing this evening, Spiros Kyrounidis. And I wish him a full recovery, that he could be with us in this kind of a setting and discuss with us, because he also personifies Greek studies, Hellenic Observatory, and therefore we miss him dearly. Kalyop has talked about individual reform initiatives, how these reform initiatives shape one way or the other a debate about the continuation of reforms inside Greece and about Greece. And I want to give you some examples how the sustainability of the reform process in Greece is actually reaching out into new policy areas that go beyond the scope of what we have done inside the book. I want to highlight there two challenges, two developments. They tell you something about the continuity of the reform process, its complexity that Kalyop has already underlined, but that there is a very active reform debate inside Greece. And that, in my view, one of the conclusions that I would draw compared to 10 years ago is that the term reform in Greece today is not toxic anymore. That was different, in particular, in connection with the term structural reform during the Troika. That has changed today. And I think part of the change can be explained in who is the agent of reform today in the country. So let me highlight, first of all, some aspects of the sustainability of Greece's economic recovery. Now, there are two developments, and Kalyop has already touched upon them, that impact the sustainability aspect. One is the pandemic, COVID-19. It came as an external shock to Greece, and not only to Greece. But it derailed an economic recovery process in the country that had slowly started to take root midway 2017. You could start to see in a number of indicators, macro and microeconomic indicators, how this recovery was starting to take root. Then comes COVID and derails that. And the second is what Kalyop mentioned with regard to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And we have in Greece, like in other countries, inflationary pressures, We have for September of this year double-digit inflation, 12.1%. That is, for the past 25 years, a tall order for Greece to bring down, not only for Greece. But, and this is the contrast again to that picture, it would be incomplete if I stopped there. The contrast is, if you look at economic activity in Greece for the second quarter of this year, it is highly positive. It's 7.7% GDP growth year on year compared to last year. That is very much a result of a very good tourist season. Tourism is coming back in full force in Greece, in particular tourists from the United States. And they compensate for the absence of tourists, for example, from Russia. Secondly, you can see, as Kalliop has highlighted, we have all macroeconomic indicators show that greater export capacity, also the diversity of export products that go abroad. Kalliop has highlighted that the enhanced surveillance framework is finally something of the past for Greece, the last country in the EU to be subject for such a long point in time of such a framework. What does this do? It creates additional fiscal leverage for the country, a sense of sovereignty, a sense of greater decision making, and that impacts on the process of defining which reforms to focus on and what resources you can use in order to implement, to execute. And then there are two resource-driven factors that we cannot underestimate that drive reform efforts in Greece that are unprecedented in their volume and scope. That is Next Generation EU and the EU budget. They provide Greece with an unprecedented volume of funding in excess of 70 billion euro. Greece has never had so much for a 7-year period combined Next Generation EU and the EU budget. Alone, if you just look at the grant dimension of this allocation of funding over the course of the next years, it's almost 20 billion. That corresponds to 10% of annual GDP of Greece in 2019. Grants, not to be paid back, 20 billion. That's an enormous amount of opportunity if done correctly, if done transparently. Greece submitted a so-called national reform plan, like any other country in the EU, to highlight how this money is going to be spent. And dubbed Greece 2.0, it focused on 62 reform agendas. Sometimes when I read that agenda, I have the impression, have they read part of our book? Have they looked at it? No, they actually had another narrative, one much closer to the LSE, and that is the important work that the Nobel laureate Christopher Pissarides has done to table such a narrative and to then see how the Mitsotakis government adopted part of it over time. What are some of its highlights? The lion's share of that reform agenda is energy-related projects. You look at such mundane issues, which in Greece make a big difference, for example, energy efficiency of residential buildings, commercial, public buildings. But you also look at the construction of additional LNG terminals. Greece tabled that 1 year ago. We didn't talk about the war yet. Greece has 3 LNG terminals and is now building 2 additional ones to have a total of 5. Germany has 0 and is trying to play catch up. Just also to put it in perspective where Greece stands, and in my view also anticipated and reacted differently to energy strategies, energy politics compared to other countries in the EU. But you also have issues like, in this reform agenda, civil protection capacity, disaster management. Why is this important? Anybody who has visited Greece in the course of last year and at the beginning of this year will remember fires, flooding and a snow blizzard. I'll come back to that issue in a moment. That means you're targeting various aspects of a broad reform agenda that tie into larger debates, for example, including climate change consequences in Greece. So in my view, there is what I would call guarded optimism that Greece can actually use these funding opportunities in a transparent and efficient manner. Why do I say that? Because if you look at how Greece has used the last EU cohesion funding from the previous 7-year period, where does Greece rank? In second position. Not bad. We didn't talk about Greece like this 10 years ago. We're doing this today. And that's why I express this guarded optimism that Greece can manage this volume of finance. It's not going to be easy, but I do think that there are signs to be optimistic. But I'm not going to only tell a success story. There are challenges that remain. Yes, the most important one is managing, and I say managing because I think at present there's very little we can do beyond that, managing the social and real economy consequences of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What does that mean at the front door in Greece? Refugees from Ukraine. Migration. That is again changing where we have discussions about the consequences of the Balkan route being reopened. How do we manage energy costs, a debate in Greece, across Europe? How do we subsidize? How do we possibly also advocate caps on? This is part of the reform debate in Greece. Greece is the only country that still does not have an investment grade as a Eurozone member state. That is another challenge that gives you leverage on international capital markets, which Greece needs. But I do think that Greece is on the way to receive such an investment grade. It would make a lot of financing issues easier in the country. Now let me turn to another aspect of domestic agency and how this has changed over the course of the past years. 5 years ago, we would never have thought about such an issue in Greece, and in particular not who is one of the key advocates of such an agenda. And that concerns the grammar of green finance. That is entering the narrative of the Greek Central Bank, one of the actors, agency that we would not have imagined a few years ago. As I said, over the course of the past 2 years, Greece has witnessed extreme weather events. The wildfires, the flooding, the snow blizzards. You can say in a word, and we have witnessed that as citizens in the country firsthand, that climate change, which frequently in Greece was something far away, somewhere else, in another country, climate change has come home in Greece. It has hit home. And you are reacting to it. There's not only a public debate about it, there's also agency about what do we do with these challenges. And one institution that is proactively engaged in this debate is the country's central bank. Yanis Tournaras, the governor of the central bank, he has started to provide policy recommendations on that issue. For example, how climate risks must be understood, as he repeatedly says in public, must be understood also as financial stability risks. And hence, how do you incorporate that into your policy-making agenda inside the central bank? On the one hand, you rewrite your annual financial stability report. And that will interest people who work, for example, in multilateral financial organizations across Europe and who look at Greece and say, okay, how do they not only analyze, but project the future and internalize aspects like climate change in their financial reporting? Secondly, the central bank has tried to slowly come up to identify what are today's sustainable asset classes that a central bank can invest in or can provide collateral for? How do you scrutinize, for example, commercial banks' energy loans in Greece? Or, for that matter, how do you define climate infrastructure as an asset class? All this is part of a very new debate and tells you something about how reform agency, but also how reform definition is moving into policy areas that we had not imagined 5 years ago. So the Bank of Greece is trying to reset within its mandate the narrative of climate change reforms and green finance in the country. Now, one last consideration in conclusion. As you will hopefully have heard, understood, we argue that the reform discussion in Greece is alive and well. It's kicking. Yes, it is complicated, and it remains controversial. How could it not? This is Greece. But there are also risks, and one of the risks of that impacts on this reform discussion in Greece is the electoral calendar. Hence, there is uncertainty on the political side in Greece. We have scheduled elections in mid-2023, next year. And these elections themselves have a novel element, which some observers would call an example of successful reform. Others actually doubt that. These are the first elections that will be held under a complete, unique system of proportional representation in Greece. Now, the outcome of these elections is open, and the jury is also out, is still out, with regard to if this electoral reform is indeed a reform. We will only be able to debate that after these elections. But for the moment, I thank you for your patience and for your attention.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, both of your presentations, but more substantively in the book, you cover a huge agenda, and it's rather difficult to focus on one particular aspect, because also I appreciate your previous writings in this area as well. So Calliope has previously written very expertly about conditionality in relation to Greece and the failings of that engagement between external institutions and domestic institutions. But I'm struck between what you were both saying about the ability to develop a domestic capacity to set goals. I think it's a great focus to have. The domestic ability to set reform goals, implying ownership therein, is a key issue. Thank you. And when I think of the, perhaps the easiest thing to start off with is a contrast between the years of the debt crisis and the years of COVID and post-COVID recovery, to try to think of some broad brush, big picture contrast. In the debt crisis, I guess we would have said that the structural constraints were severe. Institutions of governments lacked resources, lacked expertise, lacked skills, lacked knowledge, lacked information, lacked coordination capacity. Leaders in that period pursued different strategies, but whether by choice or by circumstance, they were not convergent with EU actors in terms of the objectives of reform and the content of the reform program. During the COVID and post-COVID period, however, we seem to have something of quite a contrast. This system, with the severe structural institutional incapacities. This system, in the early COVID period, seemed to have delivered very effectively. Indeed, unkind people might say that it delivered far better than, for example, the UK in addressing the COVID period. So, what did the COVID crisis? So, I just wonder how you would explain that contrast. Institutions with strong path dependency, institutions slow to adapt and slow to change. Calliope has previously spoken of the impact of conditionality as being mixed, hit and miss, etc. You also said tonight that the crisis as an opportunity didn't really survive as a narrative. And you also said about the difficulties of setting the correct priorities in terms of reform. And yet, in the COVID period, we have a policy delivery, an institutional delivery, which seems to contrast very, very favorably. How do we account for that? Is it agency? The leaders were different, but then, we might accept that as an explanation. Or was it that the mechanisms for delivery on COVID somehow were different from those of the mechanisms for delivery policy on the bailout programs? They could circumvent, they could innovate something more positively. So, what are the lessons would you think that historians in the future would draw between agency and structure in the context of the debt crisis, failing institutions, and in the COVID period, what seems to have been a much more effective policy delivery? Can I add one more thing? The ability to set, the domestic capacity to set goals. What has changed? Change number one, the European Union has been far more generous and with much less conditionality. Change number two, ideologically, policy-wise, a much greater convergence between Greece and the EU partners. So, even in the COVID period, when there has been better policy delivery, is this just fortuitous that the external actors were more benign, or is it actually a substantive domestic change? I'm only here as a warm-up artist before other people ask more interesting questions, but that's my role. Please.
Questions, pura. I think the two questions are
linked.
Yeah, linked. There are still path dependencies, and there are still difficulties, inefficiencies, whatever you want to call it. I think that for the COVID-19 policy, there has been, on one hand, agency, yes, because in some kind of an effort to prove itself, the Greek government wanted to make it a success story. So one thing is set a goal, ambitious goal. Another part is that the whole thing was built on a new basis. It was not the same organizations, the same ministries, the same which were involved in that. We have a new Ministry of Digital Governance, which has an impressive for us impressive work during the past years. And there, I think the fact that it was a priority helped this ministry also face whatever resistance, you know, it met from other ministers. One thing that this ministry did from the start, before we're going, was to try and link the different information systems, which were, you know, completely fragmented. So that was a basis which was achieved, very important basis for whatever followed. It was achieved because of agency and because of priority. It was a goal, high level ambition goal of digitalizing in general Greece. Then the second part is that it was a new ministry. It was not, you know, it didn't depend on previous arrangements, situations, etc. And that helped a lot. So it is a combination of factors. So it is the clear goal, the political support of this goal, the new structure that is not in some way held back by whatever that dependencies. So it's a mixture of reasons, I think. But the result was impressive, and even before COVID. And based on that, very quick, it was a real quick win.
Yes.
It was a real one. Because in the past, under the crisis, they were talking about quick wins, but I didn't really see them. That was a quick win. But then when COVID came, this basis allowed again a quick win, which was to build the system from scratch, which really made all this vaccination policy so incredibly non-Greek in many ways. We were surprised ourselves. So I think it is a very good example of a new policy and all of the factors that contributed to its success. Now, this capacity to set goals is uneven. There are policy areas where it is better, easier, more pronounced, and areas where it is not. But I believe that there is a part of agency and of, you know, guiding. You have to guide towards policy priorities in a clear way. Did the external environment help? Of course it did. And Jens said that reform is not a bad word. I mean, he didn't say it like that, but that's what it was. In the past it was reforms, by definition negative. There, you don't talk about reform as reform, but you talk about changes. And in that way, it is a domestication of the reform process. It's a domestic process. It's not anymore, because it's written on X memorandum or X program, but it is something that it is domestically shaped. And then there's a feeling that you need to do it because you want to do it, not because somebody else says you should. And this helps a lot, this unleashes a lot of energy, of reform energy, I believe. And of course, whatever resources come now from the EU are less, the conditionality is, there is no comparison with the IMF condition. It's a different story. So it helps, but I believe that all this describes a learning process. Let's see how it
continues. Thank you very much.
Can I just add three points?
Of course.
Okay. I think there are a number of lessons learned that in comparison between the period of the three programs and what you then highlighted with regard to COVID-19, we can see how a variety of domestic actors behaved differently. I think during COVID-19, one of the issues that I immediately noticed that was different, by deciding very early and compared to other countries in Europe, Greece was among the very first to close schools and universities. Mm. And they did it in a manner without a major controversy inside society if this should be done or not. No, this is a matter of urgency, we're going to do this. Linked to that was, in my view, an immediate and impressive communication capacity. Almost every evening, press conferences from individuals as experts and credible experts who were able to explain to an audience, why are we doing this? We never had that in the period before doing the programs. Somebody standing every once a week in front of a television screen, camera or radio and explaining why is the third program necessary or where are its challenges. The vaccination drive that Kaviok referred to is indeed a result of prior reform capacity in the area of digitalization. The manner in which we as citizens were contacted, we didn't have to take the initiative. We were contacted if we wanted to be vaccinated at a given date in a given location. I, as a German citizen living since more than two decades in Greece, was happy to be a German citizen vaccinated in Greece and not having to go through the administrative nightmare that was Germany at the beginning of the vaccination campaigns. There was really a sense of relief about that. That means Greece was prepared. But because it had prepared in other areas beforehand, and this took place despite the fact that the health sector was underfunded, was subject to radical loss of personnel, loss of capacity in terms of the mode of operation, loss of finances over the course of the years labeled austerity policies. And still that system did not collapse. I think that to put more a conceptual idea around it, I said COVID was an external shock, but it created a level of domestic agency that was impressive. The three programs were actually an internal shock and created external agency. And I think this divergence is something that you can really highlight in terms of the differences between both time periods and the challenges that they presented.
Very good, thank you. Let's open it up. I see.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Calliope. I want to ask a more kind of theoretical question about how do we define reforms and stuff. But what you said about COVID, I want to take issue with. So I'd like to connect the two things. So Greece was, celebrated in international media at the beginning of the COVID crisis for exactly what Jens was saying now. The fast response, very effective. You'd think the Germans would have done that instead of the Greeks. However, Greece now ranks in the top quarter or whatever it is of the league in terms of deaths, COVID deaths per capita, above the UK, above Brazil, above Spain, and many other countries, which also shows what a narrative can do. You think Greece is fantastic with COVID, it sticks forever. So it is not so fantastic today as it was in the beginning of the COVID crisis. And of course, it is not all. There's things that you can compare between the COVID crisis and the adjustment programs, but not everything is comparable. Like Next Generation EU versus austerity. One is a bailout that is pre-designed to go to the banks or international banks versus kind of free money and a lot of it as we have. So of course, how you respond to it and whether people are more friendly to it or take antagonistic positions is affected by that. So let me link that to the question that I want to to have, because Calliope started by saying that, which I now regret, I didn't write it down because I forget what exactly you said, but you said we defined austerity, reforms, as a continuous, sustainable, significant
departure from the status quo.
Very good definition, very good.
But
then, further down, it became almost like, you know, policy delivery, even communication, you know, so the fact that we had, you know, credible experts and technocrats telling us why vaccinations matter was also part of the reform narrative. The fact that we as Greece, of course, not me, you know, were top two in terms of absorption of the last actual funds was also something that, you know, was credited as good reforms. But this is just a policy or, you know, the performance. It is not necessarily reforms. And on reforms, there's a lot that hasn't been done. So we continue to have, for example, a minimum wage policy which does not adhere to the minimum wage legislation, as we always did, even before the minimum wage policy. And we continue to have instances where maybe there's phone tapping, maybe there's no phone tapping, and maybe the governor was involved, maybe they didn't monitor the institutions, or they did. So these are not things that you would, you know, these are the things that you would say, okay, you know, that's what I need to reform. That's the form. Now, whether the policy then is delivered successfully or is chosen, the correct policy is chosen, or it produces the right results, is of course, you know, you would hope that the structural reforms would also affect those things, the choice of policies and the effectiveness of policies. But the effectiveness of policies per se is not necessarily the, you know, the criterion, I would say. So how does, so the short version of my question is, how does this very nice definition of reforms link to then the assessment that we do, which seems to be a bit too generous for this, that yeah, they absorb the funds, so how successful the reform has been? No, they just took the money, you know, it's not necessarily that. So how do we link the kind of more analytical definition to how we then go and evaluate things on the ground, which are more about performance rather than really the technology, I call it, or the process of reforms.
Okay, there is a lot. I just one small note about the COVID deaths and all of that. There is a lot of discussion how you count.
Yes.
So I can't comment on that. Not even the specialists are sure how to count. So one country may count more because they have wider definition and other less because they have a stricter definition.
And if COVID is the primary cause.
Yes, that's the main issue. So there I can't say. Let's start in the opposite direction, policy delivery. Was Greece good at policy delivery in the past? No. So in certain areas, it's much better. So that is something that shows something is moving. Something has been done, maybe not everywhere, in certain areas. Sometimes you have to build from scratch. Sometimes you have to bypass. Sometimes you cannot bypass, and then you again stumble on the same problems. So it's uneven. That's true. But when you have a country that for many years was seen as not performing well, as not being effective in any way, or just being zero for everything, and then you see that there are many advances in even in certain areas, not everywhere, it's worth taking, you know, understanding the why there, under which conditions, etc. So I think that when policy delivery changes and is more effective, more satisfactory than it was in the past, something deeper has changed. Something has changed. So it's an indication, it's not an analysis of the process, but you have an indication that something has changed. And of course not in every policy area. some of the changes have built on reforms that started under the adjustment program, so we should not say that it did not happen. For example, electronic
payments.
E-prescription.
Oh,
okay. E-prescription. That had started already before. It was a way to control waste in the area of this. But they built on that, and that's why I said that tools have been created and can be used for better policy making in future. So that was a point that was created. It was not a big reform, but it was a very precious tool on which a new policy and better policy was built. So, the other thing is that this definition is an ambitious definition of reform. Okay. And the reason why we ended up with this, it's Guy Peters.
This one?
Guy Peters' definition.
Ah, yes, yes.
Not much. it is because we talk a lot about reforming Greece, to the point that everything is reformed. So we wanted to make sure that we're talking about deeper changes, that something that really matters, because small changes, you put this like that and then like this, and that's a reform. No, that's not a reform, but we are full of that in this. I can name many reforms in public administration, especially in human resources, that's this. We change a little bit here with no impact on everything, and then we say that's a big reform. I would say the same sometimes about education reforms and many other areas. So the idea is how far you can go, it's not easy, but how far you can go in changing. So what you can see is, and I refer to that as ideas in or out of the box. Sometimes reforms were just reproducing things that have happened before, and that there was no added value. But everybody was presenting their work as all of these reforms. And then there are silent reforms, which appear to be much bigger impact, because they probably changed something that in the past was different, was blocking these initiatives. So in that sense, the idea was not to just to describe what has changed, but what had to change, and then what changes and to what degree. You may have the same ideas coming up again and again and again, and build reforms on this same idea. That's not reform. You need to, in some way, really challenge what is there. And in order to challenge it, you have to have an idea of what is wrong. And this is the difficulty in this, because we talk so much about reform, any change is reform. But do we know what's the problem that we need to reform? And that's where I think we gained something. That the problem definition, the initial problem definition, went further into the causes of the problem in many areas. Now, what happens in, okay, these are the current politics. I wouldn't like to talk about that. It's not our issue. But yes, there are many areas where a lot has to change. Institutions have their weaknesses in this, and we know that. But it's not, I think, it doesn't help to stick to what is wrong and reproduce an image of law reformer, of law capacity, etc. Since there are some successes, let's see why this went through.
I know I'm aware of time also, but my point was that exactly that, you know, so for example, you can say that by looking at absorption rates, we can say that something changed and the administration was more effective in implementing programs. Or it could be that the co-financing requirements were withdrawn, so we didn't need to spend any money, so we just absorbed the money. So there's observational equivalence between the two. So to us to say, okay, you know, it must be that actually there were successful reforms that led to this, is in a way a bit generous, because it could be also that...
You have to go by policy area. Yeah. We cannot take it in general. We couldn't go into details right now, but...
But let me just highlight this. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I looked at the absorption capacity of these funding instruments, and what is obvious from it is, on the one hand, since it's a whole tableau of different instruments, where Greece is doing very much better compared to the past is in European regional development funding and in European social funding, absorption capacity. And I think this is a result of what Kalyop tries to highlight in terms of administrative reform capacity over time. The task force was part, for example, of the rationale, how can we increase the absorption capacity? The co-financing requirement indeed was suspended for some time, but today it exists.
Okay, we're going to run out of time, but let's invite other comments and questions, Peter. Sorry, perhaps people could identify themselves.
Yes, yeah. So I'm Peter Sanfi from the EBRD, and possibly some of you are not aware, the EBRD has been active in Greece since 2015 as an investor. In fact, it's one of the biggest countries now for the EBRD to invest in. So from my experience following Greece closely since talking very frequently to our speakers, Jens and Kalliope. In 2015, the reform debate was very polarized. And it seems that over time it has become much less volatile. There's been a sort of growing convergence. And I wonder, have we reached a point when it would be fair to say that there's almost a broad consensus about the main reforms across the main parties in Parliament? And a related question is, having been in Greece a few weeks ago and talking to a lot of people, there is a bit of nervousness about the elections. Jens, you talked about elections coming up. The fact that this bonus is removed, it means there's likely to be a period of uncertainty, and perhaps a second round, very likely a second round, and so on. And I wonder, given that there seems to be this growing consensus, or perhaps consensus is too strong a word, I'm not too sure about that, but how concerned should we be about reforms being derailed by perhaps some prolonged uncertainty and or perhaps a different type of government eventually coming out of that way? So perhaps a Syriza, PASOK, Varoufakis type coalition is one possibility, I guess, people that are talking about.
Can I just check your other questions or comments, people, please? Do you mind if we just listen? Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to ask, we are talking about reforms in the domestic landscape and how important it is to change traditional policy and progress into that. But do you also think it's important to have some reforms in terms of turning Greece into a competitive country and probably changing the scenery of Greece as a touristic destination by specializing in something particular so that we can be confident part of the EU and also the EU counterparts to see Greece as a leading economy with a specific specialization in a potential industry or something?
Thank you. Other comments or other questions? Perfect. You've got, sir? Oh, apologies, I can't see you. Please
thank go. You very much for your presentation.
Can you just identify?
I am Vasilis, I'm a student here. I'm studying the Master of European International Public Policy. And I would be interested, since we're also talking about reforms, it is a big issue in Greece. How do you measure the impact of reforms, as you mentioned, and we do mention the impact that the digital ministry had, and that there were big reforms that were done, but these reforms were of course done on a software level. And in order to measure, of course, the impact of specific reforms, once again, that is on a more general level, reforms that will happen also in the future, we need also substantial investments in the hardware, on digital hardware, so the different public administrations that would potentially be responsible for reforms, they would need to have the right tools and equipment to measure correctly their impact around, like your view on that as well, whether you're aware of what is going on in that sector.
Very good. So the reforms in terms of e-governance were the easy bits so far. Mm-hmm. Good. We've got a few minutes each to respond.
You can choose a little bit, and hopefully we are complementary to each other. Let me say something with regard to what Peter addressed, and I fully agree with you that the reform debate, including the definition of reforms, its rationale, why are we doing this, is indeed much less polarized. I'm not fully convinced that this could again go in opposite directions, but there are limits today compared to 10 years ago. So I'm rather confident to say this reform debate is one where differences of opinion can sometimes even be strong, energetic, but they also will not cast a shadow like 10 years ago, where certain constituencies emphatically did not want to even use the term as such. I think that with regard to the electoral uncertainty, because there is one voting system that will first take place, and then, depending on the outcome, possibly a very close second election on another electoral system, which will combine majority voting and proportional system, that could create a window of uncertainty, because first of all, you don't know who are going to be the leading actors in this. But I think that also it will not anymore create a level of uncertainty where you have the impression nothing moves in Greece. No. For that, we've tried to highlight a number of developments who actually tell you something, that reforms today take place even against a background of political uncertainty. And I think this is a learning process that has taken place in Greece, that even if the politics are uncertain, that doesn't exclude reforms progressing or reforms delivering impact, as we've just heard.
Yes, maybe not as optimistic, but but I believe that what has happened up to now sets an example, and any government we have to measure up to this example. So the ambition will be higher also at the governmental level, because society has seen certain things, even in easier policy areas. When an example is set, I think that the next one has to emulate a little bit, to try and reach at least that. So that is the optimistic aspect. And the risk is, I would say, differently. The risk is different depending on the policy you're talking about. When you have, there's a group of policies which is more prone to kind of distributive politics, giving out various advantages or whatever. There you may have reversals. What I don't know is if these specific areas have been so much reformed up to now so that we can talk about reversal. So maybe these are the same area, policy areas, which are the difficult parts. And then you have a group of policy areas where this is not the issue, and then they are, I can anticipate, less and less. Is there convergence in terms of ideas? I think that there are ideas maturing. I don't know if we have reached the level where we say, okay, we all agree that this has to be done. Two questions that are in some way, you know, the question of doing more. Okay. The first is do more than tourism. Okay, tourism is the easy. It's not that easy because there is an effort to diversify also to extend the tourist period. I heard that there is a new campaign saying that there is winter in Greece. In order to extend the tourism, which is clever, and I just heard it yesterday. So there is also an idea of changing tourism, not just the sea and the sun and the usual. That's one thing. But we should not. But then tourism is also very fragile. Something happens and then everything collapses. We saw with COVID. We saw the other effort that is being made currently is to bring in investments by big companies, multinationals, especially in the digital business, which is again a very good thing because this has human capital that can support, that can really be used, and this is kind of diversification of the economic activities that are expected from this.
E-governance,
yes, in some ways it is easy, and in some ways it is not, because if it is easy, why hadn't we done it before? The truth is that when you build from scratch, you have better chances to do it right, or to do it the way that you should do it. When you try to change something that exists, it's more complicated. But I think that even there is an effort to do things. How much, you know, it doesn't progress as fast as we would like, or as in other areas which are from scratch, but there is, I think, an effort. Is it sustainable? We'll have to see. I believe in the setting of an example. I think that all these initiatives, even if they do not, they are not taken up by a next government, they have been debated. They have been there. So the next government, whatever it is, has to do something similar. Maybe in that way there is some kind of convergence. I don't know.
Thanks very much indeed. I'm not quite sure whether to be optimistic or pessimistic. However, the fact that we're going to be offering you wine might redefine what we mean by optimism and pessimism. Can I just remind you, our next two events, Monday the 17th, this coming Monday at 6:30, Where Best for the Parthenon Marbles, and then on the Tuesday the 25th of October at 6 p.m, Entrepreneurship, Term Resilience in Times of Crisis. So you can get all of the information about the Observatory on the website, so they can see that our most recent newsletter is out with you as well. We have new staff in the Observatory. Let me thank James for organizing today's event and the upcoming events and all of the arrangements. But on your behalf, but also for mine, a very sincere and profound thanks to our speakers.